From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, Build Back Better passes the first hurdle in Congress. What does it mean for clean energy? The future of green energy depends on a future with mass battery storage. How is that shaping up in Texas? And the price of oil has been climbing, but is Texas able to cash in? This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Friday morning, the U.S. House of Representatives passed the Build Back Better budget reconciliation bill. The bill now goes to the U.S. Senate for consideration. There's a lot in this wide-ranging package containing many of the Democratic social spending priorities and a major part of President Joe Biden's agenda to improve the nation's social safety net, confront climate change, and help Americans bounce back from the COVID-19 pandemic and the economic fallout. The roughly $2 trillion bill would provide free universal preschool for 3 and 4 year olds, cap certain prescription drug costs, boost Pell Grants for college tuition, expand family leave, and provide new hearing benefits for seniors. It would address climate change through billions in incentive programs while also spending money to electrify up to 165,000 U.S. Postal Service trucks and create a civilian climate corps. It also increases corporate taxes. It now goes to the Senate, where it faces an uncertain future. An analysis of Build Back Better by E2 Environmental Entrepreneurs found that more than 3 million clean energy jobs will be created, and they will be generated in red and blue congressional districts. Michaela Preskill is with E2 Environmental Entrepreneurs.
This morning, with the House's passage of the Build Back Better Act, this is a real historic achievement and a big step forward for clean energy and climate resiliency and our economy in general. So the Build Back Better Act includes a few kind of key components for clean energy. It extends tax credits for solar, wind, and electric vehicles, provides consumer rebates for efficiency appliances, invests billions of dollars to help clean energy startup companies. And this will help keep us competitive with the rest of the world, like China and Europe, and even helps homeowners weatherize their homes, provides financing to build new clean energy projects, and also anticipating that this investment in clean energy is going to create millions of new jobs, also invest in workforce training to help communities link up with those jobs and really provide new opportunities and prosperity for everyone.
Unfortunately, we live in a hyper-politicized nation right now, and people are looking at whose jobs, what jobs, where jobs. And have you all been looking at that as well?
We sure have. And we know that the Build Back Better Act is going to create millions of new job opportunities. And we're not starting from scratch. The clean energy industry is already a robust foundation to build on. So there are about 3 million clean energy workers in our country already. And the thing about the clean energy industry is it is everywhere. So there are just about as many clean energy workers in Republican congressional districts as there are Democratic congressional districts. What does that mean? That means that there's nothing partisan or political about clean energy jobs. You know, they're not blue state jobs. They're not red state jobs. They're American jobs. And, you know, frankly, that means that any member of Congress who votes against clean energy and climate action is voting against the clean energy workers in their district. There's a huge foundation to build off of, and the Build Back Better Act is going to help do that.
What we're talking about in the Build Back Better, how is this going to actually increase clean energy?
It will increase clean energy in a few ways. Number one is that it will extend tax credits for the development of new solar, wind, and electric vehicles. And then it will also provide infusions of capital to startup companies that are innovating new clean energy technologies. It also sets up something called a clean energy accelerator or like a green bank, which basically will help finance small businesses and communities to build clean energy projects. So there's a few different finance mechanisms at work, but the results will be more clean energy and also cost savings. You know, a lot of this money will go directly to consumers in the form of savings on buying electric vehicles or incentives to direct consumer rebates for heat pumps and high efficiency water heaters and clothes dryers and other energy efficiency equipment in their homes.
So in previous federal tax credits available for people who buy EVs, it was a deduction that you took when you did your taxes. And depending on your income and how you structured your taxes, it wasn't always available to consumers. But I understand that this is different, that this is a tax credit when you buy your EV that's available at time of purchase. Is that correct?
Yeah, so the EV tax credit will be refundable, allowing buyers to claim it at the point of purchase. And it will also be up to $12,500, which is a $5,000 increase from what's offered today.
Right, depending on the vehicle, if it's a union-made EV made in the United States, it's $12,500. If it's not, like Teslas are not, then it's $8,000.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
The question is, all right, so we know that there is a need to switch to a green economy for the sake of dealing with this catastrophic climate change, which is real and it's happening now. It is a threat to civilization. But what is it going to do for our economy? I mean, is this overall going to be going to juice our economy?
Absolutely. And it's going to juice our economy in a few ways. First of all, we need to deal with the growing economic costs of climate change. Just this year, this past year alone, climate change cost our economy $100 billion. And that's anticipated to continue to increase until we tackle climate change. So not only are we solving the problem of rising costs due to the climate crisis, but the Build Back Better Act is going to create jobs in every part of the country. It will put money back in consumers' pockets through the form of new cost-saving opportunities, and it's going to help make America remain competitive with the rest of the world that, frankly, is already ahead of us as far as investing in clean energy technologies, electric cars, and we need to invest now to be able to keep up.
Michaela Preskill is the Midwest State's advocate for E2 Environmental Entrepreneurs. Batteries are becoming bigger and better, and their role in our grid is also growing. New data from ERCOT, the Electric Reliability Council of Texas, finds that battery storage grew in Texas 77% in just 1 month this past October. Linus Barlow, clean energy advocate with Environment Texas Research and Policy Center, explains what bigger and better battery power means for the grid stability and energy cost for consumers.
Battery storage is a super interesting and growing technology within the renewable energy space. So basically what battery energy storage allows us to do is extend the life of these renewable energy resources that we're already very familiar with, things along the lines of solar energy, wind energy, hydroelectric power. So all of those things are, as we know, dependent on if the sun is shining, if the wind is blowing, how fast a river is running. Battery power and increasing battery storage capacity allows us to utilize those renewable energy resources at times when the sun is not shining, the river is not running, things like that. So basically what this allows us to do is better tap our renewable energy potential, which is really huge for Texas as a state, which has a ton of renewable energy potential.
One thing I'm interested in, I don't know if this applies or not, but I know that when we talk about the Texas grid, that there has to be surge capacity in the grid so that when we have the very hot days, we have to be able to add more electricity, or very cold days, more electricity to the grid so that we don't have outages or rolling blackouts. And it can be very expensive to have additional capacity just sitting around, these extra, either it's a gas-powered or coal-powered power plant, or even the nuclear power plants that we have in Texas. And so could battery storage also be a solution for, in a low-cost solution, dependable solution, clean solution for surge capacity?
Absolutely. One of the greatest things about battery is how quickly it's becoming more and more affordable. When you think about just simply comparing the cost of fossil fuel-based electricity with renewables, there's a lot of entry cost to that on the front end, adapting the technology and making that more accessible, I guess is the best way to put it. But battery storage is very, very quickly becoming a really reliable and cheap way to increase the overall reliability of our electricity grid. Right now, what this report is about, that Texas currently has 833 megawatts of total battery storage capacity. That's certainly not a figure that is at the moment going to be something that the state as a whole could rely on. So in the instance of like what we saw with the winter storm last year, that 833 is by no means the solution to those sort of massive surges in electricity need. However, it's a really, really important step in the right direction and in ensuring that those type of instances are less severe in the future. One of the things that we talk about in this article is some of the predictions that Texas's energy grid, the organization that runs it, ERCOT, or the Electric Reliability Council of Texas, they're predicting that by March of 2023, that Texas as a state will have around 3,000 megawatts of battery storage capacity, which again, just looking at the growth of this sector, and especially following the bipartisan infrastructure bill and the money that that's going to put towards research and development, and getting this technology out to states like Texas that have a lot of renewable energy potential, this is really huge for combating and addressing energy surges like we saw last year in the winter storm.
Now, we have commercial large energy storage facilities, big batteries like the size of boxcars, but also people are buying power walls, and that allows them to have storage at home, but they can also, you know, because the price of power varies according to, like, it's cheaper at night, more expensive in the daytime. So can you become part of the energy storage market as a home consumer?
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. So the figure that I just said, the predicted 3,000 megawatts that are going to be added by March of 2023, that actually doesn't include small scale battery storage capacity, so things under one megawatt. So that Tesla, the power walls that you were just talking about, Tesla has said that they've sold over 200,000 of those units just in the past year, which is really doing a lot to, as we were talking about earlier, decentralizing the electricity grid so that we don't have these sort of issues of massive surges and surge pricing and outages. Those really small home-based battery storage units are, yeah, they really do allow you to have your own battery storage capacity if you have any access to renewable energy.
Linus Barlow is the Clean Energy Advocate with Environment Texas Research and Policy Center. Even if you don't need to buy gasoline, you're still being hit with this price spike in crude. High oil prices are affecting the cost of just about everything you see at the store. It's a shockwave in the economy that looks a lot like inflation. West Texas oil producers are responding to the higher prices for crude with increased production, but other parts of Texas are still lagging behind. To find out more about what's happening to the oil market, Texas production, and what, if anything, President Biden can do about it, I reached out to Jim Crane, Wallace S. Wilson Fellow for Energy Studies at the Baker Institute at Rice University.
You know, I mean, the Energy Department says it's pretty simple, right? Oil consumption is growing faster than oil production over the past 15 months, right? So the price is up. So, you know, WTI was $28 a barrel on average in the second quarter of 2020. So this quarter, it's above 80. So, you know, it's whiplash, basically, right? So, you know, if you're driving a new Ford F-150 Texas edition with a 25-gallon fuel tank, that costs you about $50 to fill up. You know, last year when gas was $2, now it's $100 to fill it up, you know, with gas almost $4 or in some places over $4. So, you know, that's basically what's going on. It's a global market, you know, oil is. So you have to think globally, right? And that's what makes it so tough to, you know, to formulate effective policy, right? You've got OPEC keeping constraints on production. They're easing back on those very gradually. But the shale producers this time around and the investors that have been sort of grudgingly loaning them cash, you know, after they, you know, after their earnings were disappointing over the past few years, you know, they all seem to be taking a page from OPEC as well these days, right? So you've got, you know, U.S. production is growing, but it's also, it's like it's same as OPEC. It's just trending gradually upward. And we're now at about 11.5 million barrels a day, which is, you know, it's still amazing, right? That's the, you know, we're the biggest oil producer in the world. And almost 5 million of that is in the Permian, right? Which is also creeping back up to almost to pre-pandemic levels. So, you know, just nobody is keeping pace with demand growth, right? As folks, you know, as we seek some sort of semblance of normalcy, or we get used to living, you know, amid a pandemic and a, you know, deadly virus, you know, we're jumping back in our cars and we're jumping back on planes, and oil demand is just shooting back up again.
Still, it does seem like the people who produce oil, people who invest in the production of oil, pre-pandemic, they had a feel for the rhythm of oil production and consumption. And now it's a different kind of rhythm because we're not 100% back to that sort of consumer economy. And also we continue, although it's very moderate right now, that's probably very generous to call the growth of EVs, but still that's something that's coming pretty quickly. So are people skittish to jump into oil production, invest in oil production, lend all that money when they're not really clear, like, how does this work? What is the rhythm?
See, that's a really good point, right? So, you know, oil producers are being cautious, right? But, you know, oil producers and investors want profits, right? And, you know, oil producers all around the world share this same common interest. And when profits are high, cranking up production like, you know, most of the importing world wants them to do is counterproductive, right? They want, you know, pain at the pump is a good thing if you're a producer, right? And so producers are, they're slow walking it, you know, partially because there's a risk, as you say, from, you know, from the virus making a comeback. But, you know, also because these profits are enjoying them. Right. So, you know, politicians like those here in the U.S., they're basically they've got the unenviable task of they've got to fight the market. Right. I mean, and here in the U.S., that's an unfair fight. Right. You know, mineral rights are privately held in the U.S. There's no state owned oil company that President Biden can order, you know, to raise production. You know, there's hundreds or thousands of oil companies in the U.S. They all take their signals from the market. So there's not that much they can do. But, you know, you mentioned EVs. You know, if oil prices go too high, or if they start spiking and, you know, jumping around too quickly, we might see OPEC changing tack. I mean, right now they're pretty happy to slow walk additional production to market, but what they don't want to see is demand destruction, right? They don't want, you know, the guy with the F-150 to get sick of paying so much money at the pump and trade it in for a Prius, or especially an electric vehicle, right? So anybody buying an electric vehicle is a former oil customer. That person is lost forever, and that's kind of a nightmare scenario for oil producers.
But President Biden is taking heat for these high prices at the pump, also because it's the increase in gasoline that's driving what we're calling inflation in the consumer market. So he has to come up with some sort of response.
Yeah, it's a thankless task. I mean, you know, he can harangue OPEC, which, you know, hasn't been working for him. You know, he's loath to get on the phone with the Saudi crown prince, you know, for, I mean, this, you know, Saudi crown prince is implicated in some, you know, in some fairly nefarious behavior, right, with the, you know, the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, the Saudi journalist who was apparently dismembered in Turkey. And so, you know, I think the Biden administration is a bit cool towards the Saudis, you know, partially, you know, due to that. But it's unclear how much influence he'd have anyway. I mean, you know, President Trump was famously tweeting to ask the Saudis to produce more oil and crank up production, and he didn't have much luck either. So, you know, I think, you know, they take it on board, but, you know, at the end of the day, they've got their plan, they follow it. I mean, Biden can also release some oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. He's been talking about that. You know, it's almost like a central bank type response. I mean, it's you know, his critics would, I'm sure, jump on that as well. You know, saying that he's taking the easy route to a problem that he's allegedly behind. I mean, fact is, the U.S. president doesn't really have much control over oil prices and you know, oil policy, really. I mean, you know, I always argue that, you know, that the federal government is a third tier player in the oil market, you know, especially here in the U.S., right? So, you know, they mostly it's the market that signals to oil firms what to do. And then state and local governments have a bit more influence, but the president doesn't have a ton of influence.
Well, what about this idea that there is a rhythm to all of this, and by the time you get the oil out of the ground in some places, like in the Eagle Ford Shale, you're no longer at $70 a barrel?
Yeah, it's also true, right? I mean, the Energy Department and OPEC, for that matter, they've both been saying that they expect crude oil prices to drop next year, right? I mean, so OPEC is sort of, you know, increasing, sort of making these gradual increases. You know, every time they meet, they bring another 400,000 barrels a day back, you know, to the market. But, you know, I just took a look. There's still 5 million barrels a day of OPEC spare production capacity that's still offline, right? So OPEC says, yep, we're gradually bringing this production back. But there's folks that credibly argue that OPEC is actually providing false assurances to the market, right? So it's enjoying raking in these extraordinary profits. And, you know, it's being, you know, it says it's got plenty of spare production capacity. It's bringing it back in a methodical way. It's probably bringing it back a little too slow to meet demand. But, you know, I mean, there are other reasons besides just wanting to keep oil prices high to be methodical. And one of those, you know, as you say, is, you know, there's still worries out there about the pandemic flaring back up and oil demand cratering again. So, you know, nobody really knows.
President Biden did run on a campaign of trying to do something about climate change, yet we're seeing him sell the federal government with these offshore oil leases recently. And, you know, he's, you have to wonder, like, how does the right hand not know what the left hand's doing with addressing energy policy?
It's sure, you know, it's you can't please anybody with you know, with the current energy policy, right? It's like you know, it's almost like you're twisting yourself into a pretzel, and nobody's happy. You know, I think what you know the crux of it is that the short term and the long term are basically in conflict, right? So, you know, the U.S. and the rest of the world, but you know, here in the U.S. in particular, we are still reliant on this energy system that's basically wrecking the climate, right? But we can't just shut it down administratively, right? It's massive, and we depend on it for everything, you know, just simply for getting to work or heating our homes or whatever,
and for jobs.
So, yeah, for yeah, exactly, for jobs. I mean, it's a huge, you know, huge component of the economy. But we still need to move to this system that can provide all these services, you know, transportation and heat and cooling without exacerbating climate change, right? So that's going to entail very careful work, ramping up the alternatives so there's substitutes for fossil fuels. You know, then we push consumers to start using those substitutes so that eventually we don't need those fossil fuels anymore. But, you know, we're not at that point yet. I mean, we still need these fossil fuels that are, you know, they're wrecking the climate, yes, but we still need them, and we totally depend on them. So we have to do them both at the same time. You know, eventually the hope is that, you know, spiking oil prices aren't going to hurt us anymore because we're not really dependent on oil anymore. We either have substitutes or we just don't use it, right? So, you know, eventually the energy transition should improve some of these things, right? Energy policy should eventually be easier when people are using, you know, electric vehicles or getting their power from renewables because they're insulated from this mess that we're seeing right now, right? If there's a, you know, I often tell my students, you know, if you drive an F-150 and Iran blocks the Strait of Hormuz, you know, are you going to notice that? Is that going to affect your operating costs? And they're like, oh, yeah, of course. You know, the gasoline price is going to go up. But what happens if the Democratic Republic of Congo blocks cobalt exports and you drive a Tesla? Are you going to be affected by that? And they think about it and they say no. You know, so, you know, a spike in cobalt or lithium has zero effect on your Tesla. You know, a rare earth shortage has no effect on, you know, whether a wind power turbine can operate. It might make your next Tesla more expensive or a new wind turbine more expensive, but it won't affect you know, the delivery or cost of electricity or transportation. So so it's like an indirect supply chain. There's less risk exposure in the future. And I think, you know, as we gain substitutes and as we move to this less direct, you know, energy a system that doesn't rely on fuel and, you know, constant 24/7, 365 deliveries of fuels, you know, we won't have so many of these, you know, inflationary price spikes we have to deal with.
Jim Crane is the Wallace S. Willow Fellow for Energy Studies at the Baker Institute at Rice University. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You can find more Texas Matters stories on our website at tpr.org, and you can download us wherever you get your podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.